Special edition of Out Your Way on the Personality Stations. This is Bill O'Brien, your host, and we're pleased to reintroduce a gentleman whose voice was heard here several decades ago, Mr. Charles Armantrout, who now lives in the Washington, D.C. area and is manager of the news department of the United States Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Armantrout, it is a pleasure to meet you, and tell us when you started back here at WJLS.
Bill, I feel right at home. I began my career here in WJLS in July of 1939, and I was an announcer, a salesman, did program directing, and I also did the newscasts and some sports casting until July of 42 when I joined the Associated Press in Charleston.
What kind of operation was it back then? Obviously, you didn't have a lot of the technical gear that we do now.
Oh, of course not. Everything was on record or live. We had a number of, as we called them in those days, hillbilly performers. Now it's country music, I understand. I suppose some of the old-timers here will remember Cowboy Jack. I think he invented the term just as he closed off. Now the old clock on the wall says it's time for us to go. Also, Judy and Julie. I understand these kids finally ended up in the big time in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was a number of years ago. Then there was a fellow by the name of George Dale. If anyone who had followed the history of WJLS will remember George Dale. He came to us in 1940, as I recall, and was a MC, a comedian, an original humorist, a show putter on her, and all things put together. George had great ambitions, and he invented, I think, the Junkyard Derby. And that's a long story, and I'm not sure whether you want to hear it all, but it's something that people remember.
I know a lot of folks don't realize the impact that radio had back then. WJLS was the only station in this region back in 1939, and what did people have to say about it when it first came on?
Oh, it was a remarkable addition to this area. Daytime radio especially, because the large stations, the networks, weren't received by the smaller towns and by isolated areas. And the signal would be almost the only one that you would tune in on your set in those days. Or you could get Bluefield, and occasionally you'd bring in a Charleston station, but WJLS was the station. It was the only station.
And of course, there were no television stations at
oh,
that
no
time.
Oh, no television, no. No FM. We were 250 watts, 1,240 kilocycles, powered duly authorized by the Federal Communications Commission. We were owned and operated by Joe L. Smith, Jr. Good morning. Here is the news. That's the way we used to open it up.
And there was no logo or anything like that, no network. Oh. We did not get CBS until later on.
No, that was long after I left. Our slogan those days was the voice of the smokeless coal fields. Do we still use that?
No, we don't. No.
Well, one of my
friends... We're still the voice, but we don't use that slogan.
One of my friends said, if you can flack that, you can flack anything, Armantrout.
How large was the staff?
As I was trying to recall, I think there were three announcers, myself, a salesman, Joel Smith, Jr., one or two engineers, and two stenographers, our secretary and the stenographer. That was it.
As announcers, you actually did announce and not really disc jockey work, right?
Oh, yes, we did just disc jockey work, too. The term hadn't been invented then. We were just playing the records. Sometimes you would play it right in the control room. At one time, we had a little dispute with the RCA people over the payment of fees for playing their records, so Joel Smith, Jr. ordered that all of them be put into a closet, and we went BMI. Is BMI still around?
Oh, yes, yes.
And we had to record every song that we played in order to pay off the proper fees to BMI and also to avoid violating the copyright. So it was quite a job. At one time, we were playing Genie with the Light Brown Hair a number of times. Those that were in the... are not copyrighted, or rather, I've forgotten the term now. It's been so long ago. In other words,
they were all patented.
No, they were all patented, or but the term had run out. The number of years they were in the almost had it. Well, it doesn't matter. Those were the good old days, though. If as far as fun was concerned, I had the evening newscast when I first started. I'll never forget them. Joe calling me saying, if you can't learn to pronounce ruthless instead of and saying it's ruthless, I don't know whether I want you on the staff or not. We also had some other strange characters. one by the name of John Gerst, a great big tall fellow who ended up on ABC. He invented the system of playing the tapes fast. He would carry on a dialogue with himself, and the voice would be played at a higher speed. So he had Sparky or some sort of a character that he would talk back and forward to. He was a great storyteller too. Last time I saw him was on a personal appearance on the stage in Charleston while I was working for the AP. Then there was Peter Antonelli. Peter Antonelli became he changed his name to Peter Darnell. Something of that order. Anyway, Pete became a producer on ABC. And I still recall the beautiful voice of Enzio Alessandrini, a local boy. He was the fall to George Dale in some of the acts we used to put on at the Legion Hall on Saturday night with all of the country music. And some of the blackout sketches that George pulled out of his memory bank they're not fit for a family audience today.
So there was a vaudeville act.
Oh, a vaudeville act.
That was put on radio.
It was done live for fee. George would advertise and sell tickets. We're right down the street here. Isn't there a hall there somewhere?
Oh, yes, the Memorial Building. Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. That's where we were. Then there was Barnes Nash, who played the piano and who could sing like a dream. Also had a little penchant for the Berry at times, but it didn't seem to bother him too much. Well, for that matter, all of us were young and thought we were very bon vivant and all that sort of nonsense. Calasino's, that's where we would repair to after we would take it off the air.
Still there? Yes.
Many a session has been, many a session with some brew. We've decided a lot of problems for WGLS.
What kind of folks would get into the new radio business back then? Was it?
Many of the people who could play a fiddle or a guitar would want to form a group and come in. And many of them had some real talent. Then I remember particularly a brace of three Italian coal miners, the Glenn White Trio. Their music wasn't a symphony, but it was good polka dancing music, and they were one of the most popular groups that we had on the air. Then there was a minister. Well, he was a preacher. Well, I suppose he was a preacher. He was on the air, and he bought his time at 6:30 every morning. And I'll not tell you where he lived because I like the fellow, and maybe I'm maligning his character. But he tells me that he had a battery box. He would jump out of bed at 6:25, turn it on, run back to bed. And then at 6:30, he'd come on there and preach his sermon. He had the ability to speak in the unknown tongues, too. I still don't know what that means.
When you get back into radio, how would you produce a newscast back then? Because we had really no teletype network.
Oh, right? Yes, we did. We had UPI.
Ah.
Had UPI, and we were Terry and Reed, or the Rip and Reed?
The Rip and Reed, yes.
Rip and Reed voice.
Still have that today sometimes, unfortunately.
Well, the war came on, and news became very important, of course, after the Germans started that last big mess. And at one point, and I can't remember when we did do this, we began to pick up the BBC broadcast of their news, and we would rebroadcast it on WJLS. And on the night that the war was declared, Barnes Nash and I were on duty. I've forgotten the name of the engineer. It might have been Al Ginkle, was at the tower. And we were broadcasting right from the Hall of Parliament. We heard Churchill, Chamberlain, all those famous names in British history. And one of them said, "The lights of Britain are going out." And then for some great timing, somebody cut off the signal. Just as daylight was beginning here and the lights of Britain were turned out for the war. I don't suppose any other radio station, certainly in West Virginia, was doing that. And I doubt if there were many in this country. But it was a real historic occasion.
How about sports? Were you able to broadcast
yes,
any
sir.
Sports?
Sports, we'd get the battery box and away we would go. You'd have to fling a telephone line for hundreds of yards and then get an AC current. And then just pray that you're going to get through. On one occasion, I went to Fairmont. I was the color man. Charlie Boyd was the announcer. And Bill Barrett, poor Bill Barrett. He ran the tables here.
Yeah, he went on to Washington, right?
He went to Washington. He became one of the top editors of UPI. And I called his boss here about a year or so ago. I said, "Well, how's Bill?" And the business editor of UPI, and she said, by this time he was handling all the computer arrangements for that great news outfit. And she says, "Hold your breath." And I said, "What do you mean?" "Hold your breath," said he just passed away over in the ticket office of the airline. He was getting ready to take a trip. Bill was a particular friend of mine, great, big, good-hearted, a religious fellow, a World War II veteran, sports editor of the Beckley Post-Herald when he came here. A nice fellow. Allison, there have been some tremendous characters through this, that I know in those days that have gone through here. I don't think I've mentioned them all.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of talent, no doubt about it. Did you travel quite a distance then to follow? I guess it was Beckley Sports that you...
Beckley High School, Flying Eagles. Well, no, the Flying Eagles at that time thought it would ruin their attendance. We were doing the Mount Hope games, as I recall.
Oh, really?
And the sponsor was the Blackburn Ford Company, of which Mr. Oakie L. Patterson was then associated with, and perhaps he still is. Oakie Patterson and I became friends from that day, or the days when I sold him the program. And later, as he became governor, he offered me quite a responsible job in the state government, but I decided not to take it because of various reasons. At that time, I'd worked my time with the Associated Press, and I'd joined Chapman Rivercombe, the late senator in Washington. And we had a little disruption of our careers in the 1948 election. And I went back to work on the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette. They gave me a daily column, and I got all the best assignments, I thought. And Oakie L. Patterson looked at my work on the state mental hospitals and asked me to become chairman of the Board of Control. But I didn't feel that I was qualified to be an administrator. I'm strictly a newsman, and this is what I'm dealing with now in Washington with the U.S. Chamber.
What made you leave radio?
Well, I'd started in radio on WHIS in Bluefield, and the Schott family that owned the station and also owns the newspapers, they had two in those days, they moved me over to the Sunset News, and I became a reporter there, and this had been one of my ambitions. And when the job opened up in the Associated Press, why, I jumped at it. And that was really my education, because covering for the wire services in those days demanded a lot of initiative, a lot of intelligence, of which I didn't have much at the beginning, and some enthusiasm. And I spent 5.5 years with the Associated Press, and was transferred to Baltimore, and it was at that period I joined Chapman Rivercombe early in 1948.
When you were on staff here, Mr. Armentrout, at WJLS, any situations that really got you into trouble during those early years?
I can't remember any serious ones. I know that we took our mobile unit, of which Al Ginkle ran from a Plymouth station wagon. As I recall, it was only licensed for 100 watts. Now, you can't get out of these hollows with 100 watts. But Ginkle had a touch of genius in him. And that mobile unit, he told me once, he thought he had it up to about 1,000 watts. That means that he could throw by short wave the signal from the top of Flat Top Mountain, where we were describing the Lilly family reunion back in 1939 or 40, or maybe it was 41 or 42. And the opposition, or we didn't consider them opposition, WCHS, the big station, the big city, came down to also do a remote, and they'd rented a telephone line somewhere near the operation, but the only signal they could get out was our 1,000-watt signal. We finally had to cut off and let them go ahead and do their broadcast. Those were the days when the Lilly family reunion was one of the great events in West Virginia. Jack Dempsey would be their guest. Senator Taft, as I recall, was here one year. And then in 48, Senator Harold Stassen came down to address the crowd. I rode down in the police cars with him as he came in to address all of this great multitude. They'd also have a carnival on the grounds. There would be a 3 or 4 day celebration. Do they still do this?
They are going to revive it out there this coming year.
Well, it's a part of the history of this area, and there are an awful lot of lilies.
Oh, yes. Were there any other remote broadcasts that you would do?
Oh, we would take the truck and put a long lead to the mic and follow right behind it at a parade, the Christmas parade. Talk to the guests, run way up in front of the truck, and you move along slowly. Talk to the kids and ask them how they like the parade, and here comes Santa Claus, and then move on up the street, up Main Street. We had a fellow that ran the tables. What was his name? Homer? Oh, dear, poor Homer. I can't remember his name. He's now dead. But Homer was pretty good size, so we decided that we needed a Santa Claus for this particular parade. I think this was in 39. And Joe had an open Ford touring car. But we didn't think that we should bring Santa Claus in just in a car, so someone thought up that, look, we'll put him up in that Piper Cub that so-and-so has out at the airport, and we'll fly him down low and let him wave. Then we'll meet him with the car and say that he's jumped out in a parachute and bring him into town. Now, you just can't have Santa Claus riding in the car. You got to have something to give the kids. So we got a bunch of hard candy wrapped in paper and filled up a big bag through. And now we've got him up in the air. Here's Santa Claus waving as he goes up and down Main Street, and it's a wonder he didn't strike one of the buildings. And then about 20 minutes later, here he comes into town in the backseat of the car. And he starts throwing away the candy. And here came the kids. And Santa Claus saying, "Get away from me! Get away from me, you little so-and-so! Get away from me!" He's afraid they're going to mob him. As I recall, the late Pat Murphy, who was the commercial manager then, and I got on either side on the running boards. There were still running boards in those days, and we sort of held the kids off while we raced him out of town. Homer said he never wanted to go through an experience like that, never again.
To wrap this up, and we could go on, but what do you feel is the biggest change in radio in the last 40 years? And what a question, huh?
Oh, the resurgence of it. When television came in, the dire predictions, no one's going to listen to radio, everybody being into television. Radio, I think, has, according to the figures, have doubled and redoubled its audiences, and you can get more information from radio. Gee, the tube is good, and it does a grand job of giving you an actual event, but they're not as flexible. You're far ahead of them in information, in good music, and time, weather. Radio's got a great future, and you know it.
We thank you very much for talking about the past, especially here at WJLS. Thanks for coming by.
Happy to do it.
Mr. Charles Armantrout, who is now manager of the news department for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce out of Washington, visiting with us today on Out Your Way. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you for tuning in.